Facing Mount Kanchenjunga by Sangharakshita, an English Buddhist in the Eastern Himalayas. Windhorse Publications, 1991. Read by Subhadra. Chapter 1. On My Own in Kalimpong. Quote, "Stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. The Nyuas will look after you." End quote. As the jeep that was taking Kashyapji down to Siliguri disappeared round a bend, I was left standing at the side of the road with my teacher's parting words ringing in my ears. I was 24 years old. Since becoming Kashyapji's disciple 7 months earlier, I had not been separated from him for more than a few days, and now, barely 3 weeks after our arrival in Kalimpong, he had suddenly decided to leave me there. It was a brilliantly sunny day in March. Above me was the fathomless blue of the sky. Around me were the foothills of the eastern Himalayas, the great jagged ridges running together from all directions. In front of me, far away to the north, rising behind the exact middle of a gigantic saddleback, were the dazzling white peaks of Mount Kanchenjunga. For the first time in my life, I was on my own. I had not been on my own in the army, which had originally brought me to India. I had not been on my own during my 2 years as a wandering ascetic. But now, left standing there at the side of the road in the sunshine, that morning in March 1950, I was on my own at last, with no one to whom I could look up in any way, and with no one to help me but myself. As I climbed the acclivity that led in three sharp bends from the road to the double-fronted two-story building where we had been put up, I thought about Kashyapji's parting words to me, quote, "Stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. The Nyuas will look after you." Unquote. The first part of this injunction presented no difficulty. Already the scenery and atmosphere of Kalimpong had made a deep impression on me, and I was perfectly willing to go on staying in such an inspiring and magical place. Working for the good of Buddhism was another matter. Less than a year had passed since my ordination as a Shramanera or novice monk at Kusinara, and although I was willing to do everything in my power to carry out my teacher's instructions, I doubted whether I was as ready to work for the good of Buddhism as Kashyapji apparently thought, especially if, as seemed likely, I would be working on my own. I also doubted whether the Nyuas were ready to look after me. From what I had seen, they were not ready to look after Kashyapji himself. They had certainly shown no interest in making it possible for him to settle in the area, a step which, for a time, he appeared to be contemplating. The Nyuas in question were, of course, the Buddhist, as distinct from the Hindu, Nyuas of Kalimpong. Like their counterparts in Bhutaul and Tansen, to whom Yu Chandramani had sent me to preach the Dharma immediately after my ordination, they came originally from the Kathmandu Valley, with which their social, economic, cultural and religious ties were still very close. Some of them were merchants engaged in the highly lucrative import-export trade between India and Tibet. Others were goldsmiths and silversmiths. Others again were shopkeepers and petty traders. All, so far as they could, employed only fellow Nyuas, preference generally being given to blood relations. One of the town's most prominent Nyua merchants was Gyan Jyoti, the second of the four brothers who made up the firm of Jyoti Brothers. Kashyapji had met him in Calcutta the previous year, when he had taken the opportunity of letting my teacher know that if he ever wanted to escape from the heat of the plains for a few weeks, he would gladly make arrangements for him to stay in Kalimpong. As a true monk, as well as a genuine son of the soil, Kashyapji was not bothered by heat, but we were on holiday from Banaras Hindu University, and after he had shown me some of the holy places of his native Bihar, the ancient Magadha, we boarded the train at Patna, and from there made the 300-mile journey to Siliguri, which was the railhead for Kalimpong. Gyanjoti did not forget his promise. At Siliguri, there was a jeep waiting for us outside the station, and on our arrival in Kalimpong, 3 hours later, we were driven straight to his home for lunch. When we had eaten and rested, our host, a smooth-faced, smiling man of about 30, in semi-traditional dress, white jodhpurs and black English jacket, took us to the Dharmodaya Vihara, or, inverted commas, Monastery of the Rise of the Teaching, as the building at the top of the acclivity was called, where he had made arrangements for us to stay. Before leaving, he invited us in the most cordial manner to take our bhiksha, or alms food, the polite term for the monk's single pre-midday meal, at his home each day. For a week or more, all was well. At 10:30 every morning, having studied the Dhammapada together for a couple of hours, Kashyapji and I made our way to Nepali Building, which was situated on the other side of the road, which was situated on the other side of the town, less than a mile up the road from the Vihara. Here, in the living quarters above the business part of the premises, we were given our meal. As the newer custom was, the dishes were all strongly impregnated with garlic. The newars themselves, in fact, were redolent of garlic. For 3 or 4 days we were served with full ceremony in strictly orthodox fashion, for the newars of Kalimpong, like those of Bhutao and Tanzan, had in recent years come under the influence of a Ceylon and Burma-based, quote, reform movement, which in practice meant little more than that their own vulgarized and debased Vajrayana had been to some extent overlaid with a veneer of imported Theravada formalism. Before Kashyapji and I could eat, therefore, refuges and precepts had to be administered, verses of blessing recited, a short discourse delivered, and so on. Moreover, each dish had to be individually offered, that is to say, actually lifted up and placed in our hands. At the end of 3 or 4 days, ceremony was first quietly abridged, then dropped altogether, our food being simply placed in front of us with a polite folding of hands and a smiling intimation that we should fall to without further ado. There were also fewer servants in attendance than before, and more often than not, Gyanjoti himself was not present. This did not particularly surprise us. Gyanjoti was a busy man. His servants, no doubt, had work to do, and it was only to be expected that as people became accustomed to our presence, they would treat us with less formality than at first. On the 9th or 10th day after our arrival in Kalimpong, we turned up at Nepali Building as usual, only to find that no one was expecting us that morning. Though our meal was quickly prepared, something had evidently gone wrong. Later in the day, Gyanjoti came flying along to the Dharmodaya Vihara, full of apologies for the apparent discourtesy with which we had been treated, explained that there had been a misunderstanding, assured us that he had given the servants a good scolding for their remissness, and insisted that we should go on taking our meals at his place. We therefore gave the matter no further thought. A few days later, the same thing happened again. Kashyapji and I found it difficult to believe that a second misunderstanding of this sort could occur so soon after the first. Had we outstayed our welcome? Or was there some disagreement between Gyanjoti and his servants? Were they his servants anyway, or were they his elder brother's servants? And in that case, how much control over them did our smooth-faced host actually have? We did not know what to think. Only one thing was certain. The present ambiguous state of affairs could not be allowed to continue. Though further apologies and explanations were forthcoming from Gyanjyoti, who appeared genuinely distressed by what had happened, Kashyapji decided that we should discontinue our morning visits to Nepali building. In any case, it was not in accordance with the best monastic practice that, when there were so many Nyuar merchants in Kalimpong, we should rely on just one of them for our support. Come to think of it, it was strange that none of the other merchants had invited us to their homes or shown signs of wanting to share with Gyanjyoti the responsibility and the merit of looking after us. There was a reason for this apparent reluctance, but what it was I discovered only several months later. Having decided on the course we should take, Kashyapji had a frank talk with Gyanjyoti, explaining that since we had already given his servants more trouble than we ought, and felt reluctant to give them any more, we hoped that from now on he would excuse us from taking our bhiksha at his home. At the same time, he thanked Gyanjyoti warmly for all that he had done for us and was in fact still doing. Such was Kashyapji's tact, and so patent his sincerity, that we were able to discontinue our visits to Nepali building without detriment to the cordial relations that had developed between our well-meaning host and ourselves. As so often happens, the solution of one problem only resulted in the creation of another. The ambiguous state of affairs that had arisen in connection with our visits to Nepali building was now resolved. But what were we going to do about our bhiksha? As a professor of the Benares Hindu University, Kashyapji drew what by Indian standards was a handsome salary, and he had come to Kalimpong not unprovided with funds. What was more, he was quite prepared to dip into his own pocket whenever necessary in order to defray our expenses. We could take our meals at a Brahmin, that is, vegetarian, restaurant in the bazaar, or alternatively, we could buy provisions and get the old woman who lived in the outbuildings behind the Dharmodia Vihara to do our cooking for us. She was already making our morning and afternoon tea, and would probably be glad to earn a little extra money. In the end, we decided against both these courses. It would not do for monks to be seen eating in a public restaurant, and we did not really want to go to the trouble of setting up an establishment of our own, especially as we would not be staying in Kalimpong much longer. There was no doubt that the best course for us to take was the simplest. It was also the one which was the most traditional and the most truly Buddhistic. Why had we not thought of it before? We would rely for our bhiksha not on any one person, however charitable, but on the religious-minded general public. With our begging bowls in our hands, we would go from door to door for alms. That was the solution to our new problem. We had, of course, recently gone for alms in the towns and villages of Bihar. Kashyapji at that time had no previous experience of the practice, at least not since his return from Ceylon 12 years earlier, and he doubted if the ancient Buddhist tradition of alms gathering, as distinct from ordinary religious mendicancy, could really be revived in 20th century India. From my experience when walking from Kusinara to Lumbini immediately after my ordination, I believed that it could be, and managed to convince Kashyapji that we should at least make the attempt. For a few days we created a minor sensation among the good folk of Bihar. People wept with emotion to see yellow-robed Buddhist monks standing for alms outside the doors of their own homes, a sight that had not been seen for 600 or 700 years. Now that we had decided not to rely on any one person in Kalimpong for our bhiksha, we would see if what had been possible in one part of the country was possible in another. Next morning at 10:30, equipped with our begging bowls, we therefore sallied forth from the Dharmodia Vihara and made our way to the bazaar. Though we created less of a sensation than in Bihar, within an hour we collected as much food as we needed and returned from our expedition well satisfied. For the rest of the time that Kashyap G was in Kalimpong, we went alms gathering together each day. The practice had many advantages. Besides solving the problem of what we were to do about our bhiksha, it brought us into contact with people whom we might not otherwise have met. We even became acquainted with some of the other new alms merchants of Kalimpong. But though one or two of these invited us to their homes for a meal and listened politely when Kashyapji spoke of his idea of starting an institute for the study of Pali and Buddhist philosophy at a suitable place in the hills, it soon became obvious that no one was interested in helping him stay on in Kalimpong or prepared to do anything more for him than provide him with the occasional ceremonial bhiksha. Thus, it was not surprising that, 10 or 12 days after the start of our alms-gathering expeditions, and less than 3 weeks after our arrival in Kalimpong, my teacher should suddenly decide to return to the plains. In the course of our holiday, he had made up his mind at last to resign from the Benares Hindu University. But not knowing as yet what to do after that, he now wanted to stay quietly in Bihar until he found out. Fired by the prospect of freedom after 12 years of academic servitude, and anxious to be on his way, he paid a hurried visit to Gyan Jyoti and left Kalimpong the very next morning, directing his parting injunction to me from the jeep: "Stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. The Nuwas will look after you." Whether Kashyapji ever seriously thought that the Nuwas would look after me, I do not know. Probably he reckoned that, as I was not only a stranger in the town but also European, my co-religionists would at least not allow me to starve, especially as I was a monk. Whatever he may have thought when he decided to leave me in Kalimpong, I had no wish to take advantage of my white skin and no wish to be a burden to anyone. After Kashyapji's departure, I therefore continued to go alms-gathering as usual. So far as I was concerned, the alms round was an integral part of monastic life, and I had no wish to abandon the practice, even if it had been possible for me to do so. A monk's robes and his bowl were his two wings, and equipped with them, he was free to go or to stay, wherever he pleased, dependent on all and dependent on none. With robe and bowl, therefore, I made my way from the Dharmodia Vihara to the bazaar at 10:30 each morning, not walking at a respectful distance behind Kashyapji as before, but on my own. As the custom was, I went barefoot with lowered head and did not speak to anyone on the way. According to the most austere tradition, a monk should gather alms without omitting any house, but accepting from all impartially, whether rich or poor, believing or unbelieving. Kashyapji had chosen not to follow this procedure. We had accordingly begged — the Buddhist monk is not supposed actually to ask for alms, thus differing from his Hindu counterpart — exclusively from Buddhist Nuwas and such Hindu Biharis and Mawaris as Kashyapji had become acquainted with in the course of the week following our arrival. At first I continued to go for alms in this way, but as the weeks went by, I gradually extended the scope of my operations, preferring to take smaller amounts of food from a number of houses rather than take larger amounts from only two or three, even though this meant going further afield and in consequence spending more time on my alms round. Such an extension of the scope of my operations would, I hoped, better enable me to act upon the Buddha's advice to the wandering monk, and, as the Dhammapada puts it, quote, "Gather alms in the village, even as the bee, without injuring their colour or scent, collects honey from the flowers." For the greater part of the way, my alms round lay along the road
between the Dharmodaya Vihara and Nepali building. This road, which was the main road, ran straight through Kalimpong, winding up from the plains of Bengal to join the middle of the saddleback along which the town was spread out, and plunging down, a few miles further on, into the valleys of southern Sikkim. My first halt after leaving the Dharmodaya Vihara was about halfway along the high street, at the open-fronted shop of a Mawari cloth merchant. This merchant was extremely kind to me. As soon as I took up my station outside his shop, he would appear from the back part of the premises, where the living quarters were situated, with a brass tray piled high with rice, curried vegetables, and crisp, crinkled-up poppadoms. Had I allowed him to do so, he would have filled my bowl to the brim. At the end of the high street, the road divided, the left-hand fork winding on up to Nepali building and beyond, the right-hand fork falling steeply into the lower reaches of the bazaar. My way lay along the first of these. On the left, on the way up to Dairo, the pine-covered hill that formed the more northerly hump of the saddleback on which Kalimpong was situated, stood the buildings of the Church of Scotland Mission, the most prominent among them being a church, the grey square tower of which was one of the first things one saw on entering the outskirts of the town.
On the right, backing onto the lower bazaar, stood a straggling row of open-fronted wooden shops, none of them more than a single story high, and all rather ramshackle. Indeed, they looked as though they might fall down any time. Outside three of these shops, in turn, I halted for a few minutes. The first two, which were situated next door to each other, belonged to two Newar silversmiths, with furnaces and shabby display shelves, both occupying the front part of the premises, facing onto the street, while the third shop contained the dispensary of a Bihari homeopathic doctor. In contrast to the Mawari merchant, who wore a white shirt and dhoti and a bright yellow pugari, the Bihari doctor wore a white dhoti, a long navy blue waistcoat, and a brown pillbox hat of the Nepalese type. As for the two silversmiths, they and their two teenage sons and nephews were dressed in loose-fitting white jodhpurs and double-breasted Nepalese shirts that made them look as though they had just got out of bed, especially as they were all red-eyed from bending over these small charcoal furnaces. At each of the three shops, I was received with folded hands and given a few spoonfuls of rice and curried vegetables. Depending on how much food I had already collected, I either went round to the back of the shops where an old Newar woman lived, or on past Nepali building to Kodamol building, a cold, gloomy warren of a tenement block, in different parts of which stayed four or five Newar merchants. Sometimes I did not go to either place, but went straight back to the Dharmodaya Vihara. All the way along the road there were, of course, plenty of shops and houses other than the ones at which I had stopped with my bowl, but some of these were occupied by Tibetans and Chinese, and not being sure of getting vegetarian food from them, I did not include any of them in my alms round.
Since I went on my alms round with lowered head, I did not see much of Kalimpong on such occasions. Apart from the road immediately in front of me, all I saw was legs. Some of the legs were short and thick, of the colour of weak tea, with enormously developed calf muscles, almost like footballs. These, as I knew, were the legs of Nepalese coolies, dozens of whom could be seen at any hour of the day, straining beneath the weight of enormous loads, borne on their backs in cone-shaped wicker baskets. Others were black and stick-like, with ends of off-white dhotis flapping above bony knees. Some legs were sheathed in tight-fitting white jodhpurs, or were encased in Western-style trousers, while others were decently concealed behind the skirts of black, brown, or blue gowns or heavy maroon robes. Besides human legs, there were animal legs. There were the dun-coloured legs of the mules, and they sometimes passed by in such numbers and raised such clouds of yellow dust that I was forced to stand at the side of the road until they had passed. Some pairs of legs were going in the same direction as I was, others in the opposite direction. Some moved quickly and briskly, some slowly and saunteringly. For my own part, coming and going, I did my best to maintain the modest, measured gait considered appropriate to the alms-gathering monk. Back at the Dharmodya Vihara, I washed the dust from my feet, rested for a few minutes, and then ate the food I had collected. Or rather, I ate part of the food. Though Kashyapji had left me on my own in Kalimpong, he had not left me alone. The fact that I was now responsible for myself did not mean that I was responsible for no one but myself. My begging bowl was having to support not one person, but two, and in the months to come would have to support even more. Tilakdari Prasad Singh was a 20-year-old Bihari whom we had met in Rajgir, where he was attending the training camp for village workers, which Kashyapji and I had been invited to address on topics ranging from Buddhism to naturopathy. Like other young men we had met in the course of our tour, he was interested in Buddhism, at least the extent that it formed part of the cultural history of his native Bihar. And he not only attended all our talks, but spent a great deal of time in our company. By the conclusion of the training camp, he was wanting to give up his job as a village worker and become a monk. However suited or unsuited to the monastic life Tilakdari may have been, there was no denying the fact that he had developed a strong attachment to us. By nature, he was indeed a warmly affectionate person. When the time came for Kashyapji and me to leave Rajgir, he burst into tears and was so distressed at the idea of parting from us that my kind-hearted teacher invited him to accompany us to Kalimpong. Thus it was that, in the weeks following Kashyapji's departure, I came to be sharing with him each day the contents of my solitary begging bowl. The young man with whom I had been thrown into such close contact was of medium height and slightly built. He had a thatch of very thick, very wavy black hair, from which protruded the knotted crown lock of the caste Hindu. Beneath the thatch was a brown pug face with a low, heavily corrugated brow and a pair of small, deep-set brown eyes, the corners of which were quite yellow, as though with debauchery. Under a long navy blue waistcoat, he wore a kurta, or Indian collarless shirt, and medium-length dhoti. All three garments were of coarse hand-loom cloth, as befitted a member of the Congress Party and a village worker, and thus had a crumpled look, as if in need of ironing. His brown feet were stockingless, and thrust into a pair of down-at-heel shoes several times too large for him, that slapped up and down when he walked. Like many Indians, he walked with a curious forward jerk of the knee. On the side of his head he wore a white hand-loom forage cap, thereby proclaiming his adherence to the Gandhian and Congress principles of truth and non-violence. By way of a concession to modernity, he sported a cheap fountain pen, a pair of sunglasses, and a scarf thrown rakishly back over one shoulder. His mother tongue was the unpolished Hindi of rural Bihar, but he also spoke, or at least understood, a little English. Since our arrival in Kalimpong, I had been giving him English lessons, and after Kashyapji's departure, these lessons continued. Indeed, other subjects were added to the curriculum. Besides English, I taught him something of Buddhism and introduced him to the practice of meditation. Not that the gains were all on his side. From time to time I practiced my Hindi on him, getting him to correct the grammar and pronunciation. and this way we got on well together. He had always been more attached to me than to Khashoggi, and as the weeks went by, his attachment turned into devotion. This did not mean that there was never any friction between us. His loud voice and uncouth manners often jarred on me, and no doubt there were times when he found my English reserve no less trying. Since he wanted to be a monk, I did my best to disabuse him of his caste Hindu prejudices, which were still quite strong, as well as to make him realise that his faults and weaknesses were really such and ought to be got rid of as soon as possible. More often than not, he at first put up a show of resistance. Kayasthas really were superior to Shudras, even if not to Brahmins. It did not really matter if he smoked in the toilet and afterwards told me he had not done so. If I thought he really meant what he said, or that there was a genuine misunderstanding to be dispelled, I went into the matter more deeply and argued with him until the truth was clear beyond doubt or cavil. His resistance would then suddenly collapse. He would admit he was wrong, and the brown pug face would be irradiated with a disarmingly innocent smile. At such moments, I felt my efforts had not been wasted. When I was not teaching Tilakdari or arguing with him, I sat cross-legged on my bed by the window in one of the upstairs front rooms, either reading or writing. From where I sat, I had an uninterrupted view of the hills, with Mount Kanchenjunga rising triumphantly above its saddleback, and whenever I became tired of concentrating on the printed page, or whenever inspiration flagged, I lifted up my eyes and allowed them to rest for a while on the gleaming white mass of the snow peaks, all the whiter for being seen against a background of deep yet brilliant blue. The Dharmodia Vihara was indeed an ideal place for study and literary work. Built originally as a European family house, it stood surrounded by its lawns and flower beds on a ledge cut in the hillside. Below, but out of sight, was the road. Behind, a series of steep terraces, some of them showing signs of cultivation. On the bazaar side of the vihara, half hidden by a clump of large trees, could be seen the red corrugated roofs of the neighbouring bungalow, while on the other side there was a jora, or gully. In this jora, which marked the boundary of the property on the western side, handsome 30- and 40-foot bamboos grew so thickly as to form a living screen. Though well built, the vihara was not very big. There were two sizable rooms both upstairs and downstairs, besides four smaller rooms. One of the pleasantest features of the building was the abundance of woodwork. The smaller rooms at the back were made entirely of dark brown wood, as was the gallery that ran the entire length of the building on the first floor. This gallery, to which there was access from both inside and outside the house, shed an interesting light on the domestic arrangements of the British in India, as well as showing the extent to which these were influenced by indigenous ideas. It was by means of this gallery that the sweeper gained entry to the back door of the upstairs toilets, which meant they could be cleaned without his actually entering the house and contaminating it with his unclean presence. The Dharmodia Sabha, or Society for the Rise of the Teaching, the Nyuwa Buddhist organisation that had acquired the building a year or two earlier, had chosen to continue this arrangement. Once or twice a week, therefore, a dark, furtive figure could be seen or heard climbing the outside staircase, padding along the gallery, and swishing his stiff reed broom around inside the two toilets. The most important room in the vihara was the room next to the one occupied by me. This room was, of course, the shrine room. Here I performed my devotions each morning, reciting the salutation to the three jewels and other verses, and meditating for a short period. An image of the Buddha had been installed in the octagonal bay window between two orange curtains. It was a Burmese alabaster and gilt image, rather squat and square-featured, and it was planted in the middle of a small table. On the table, in front of the image, was a silver Tibetan butter lamp, such as the Nyuar silversmiths themselves made, flanked by vases of flowers. Beneath the table stood a copper jug containing clarified butter, from which the lamps were replenished. On most days, I was the only person to make use of the shrine. Apart from Tilak Dari and myself, there was no one staying at the Vihara, and such visitors as did come were of the talking rather than the worshipping type. Gayan Jyoti and 15 or 20 other Nyuars came only on the occasion of the full moon day, and, though less regularly, on the new moon day. Women and children came in the morning, bringing clarified butter to pour into the copper jug, flowers and packets of candles, paper twists of Nepalese incense, and handfuls of rice and small change, which, in Nyuar fashion, they scattered over the image table. They also offered me my morning bhiksha, either bringing it with them in a tiffin carrier, ready cooked, or preparing it in one of the outbuildings with the help of the old woman, so that I did not have to go out on my arms round that day. In the evening came the men, who generally stayed quite late, singing devotional songs to the accompaniment of a portable harmonium. Both morning and evening, I would be requested to administer the refuges and precepts, perhaps to deliver a short discourse, and there would be a great deal of bowing down. On such occasions, I was reminded of the happy weeks that, the previous year, I had spent with the Nyuars in Nepal, at the Padmagaba Vihara in Bhutao, and at the Mahachaitya Vihara in Tanzan. But though the general pattern of observance was the same, in Kalimpong, at the Dharmodaya Vihara, there were fewer people, the devotion was not so heartfelt, and I was conscious of strange undercurrents I could not understand. Next to the shrine room in importance was the library and reading room. This was situated downstairs in the room below the shrine room and contained 300 or 400 books. Among these were odd volumes of the Burmese and Thai editions of the Tripitaka, Hindi translations of Pali Buddhist texts, both canonical and non-canonical, works on Buddhism by modern Hindi writers, including Bhikkhu Kashyap, and books in the Nyuari language, but printed, this was a recent development, in Devanagari characters. Most of the books in the library, however, were Hindi romantic novels of the cheapest kind. On a table in the centre of the room lay a pile of newspapers and periodicals, among them two or three Buddhist magazines in English. Behind a smaller table inside the door sat the librarian. At least he sat there when the library and reading room was open, which was from 6 till 8 in the evening. Not more than 10 or 12 people ever patronised the place in a single day. They consisted mostly of older men who came to browse through the newspapers, and younger women and girls who came to borrow Hindi romantic novels. All withdrawals were solemnly recorded by the librarian, who put on a pair of rimless spectacles for the purpose, and wrote in his book with much flourishing of the pen, and many fatherly leers at the female borrowers. The librarian was, of course, a Nyuar. When Kashyapji and I first met him, he greeted us with fulsome politeness, but he was clearly ill at ease in our presence. And after Kashyapji's departure, it was obvious from his manner that he wanted as little to do with me as possible. He was about 40 years of age, but quite bald, and with his close-set, rather prominent eyes and wide, trap-like slit of a mouth, he looked curiously like a bullfrog. When he stood up, his spindly legs and bloated belly made him look more like a bullfrog than ever, especially in the tight-fitting Nepalese garments he wore. When he spoke, it was not with a deep, croaking sound, however, but in the high-pitched yelping tones that I had come to recognise as characteristic of the male Nuwa. Some weeks after Kashyap G had left Kalimpong, I found in the glass-fronted wall cupboard in my room, behind some books, a framed photograph. The photograph showed a rather stern-faced Buddhist monk in Theravada robes standing against an indeterminate background. I had seen that face somewhere before, but where it was I could not remember. Had it been in Nepal or in India? Eventually the truth flashed on me. The face in the photograph was the face of my bullfrog friend, the librarian. Did the latter, then, have a brother who was a monk? Or had he once been a monk himself? Bit by bit I heard the whole story. Mahapranya, or Great Wisdom, as the librarian was called, had indeed once been a monk. He had been the best known of all the Theravada Buddhist monks of Nepal, the best known of all the so-called reformists who were trying currently to replace a colourful but corrupt Vajrayana with a pure but sterile Theravada. He had been a Thera, or elder monk, having completed 10 years as a member of the monastic order, and many of the younger monks had been his disciples. He had travelled to Ceylon and Burma. He had practised meditation, especially the 10 corpse meditations. He had been an accomplished and highly popular preacher in Niwari, as well as being fluent in Hindi, Nepali and Sinhalese. Above all, he had been a fearless opponent of the caste system, then still enforced by law in Nepal, and had had the honour of being personally flogged by the hereditary Prime Minister for daring to criticise it in public. On the opening of the Dharmodia Vihara, he was invited to come and stay there. Shortly after his arrival, he fell ill, being confined to the very bed by the window now occupied by me. Naturally, the Nuwas looked after him, or rather, the Nuwa women looked after him. One of them, a widow with several young children, was particularly assiduous in her attentions, visiting the sick monk daily, spending hours at his bedside, and in short, doing everything she could to assist his recovery. One day, a group of Nuwas came to see him, out of respect, removing their shoes in the hall and stealing up the stairs in their stockinged feet. As I knew, the sound of stockinged feet on the stairs could not be heard from inside the room. On opening the door, they found Great Wisdom and the widow locked in an embrace typical of the Vajrayana rather than of the Theravada. As a result of this, he had been forced to leave the Vihara. Now, no longer a monk, he lived with the widow in the bazaar, where she kept a vegetable store, and they already had, or were about to have, a child. In consideration of his past services to Buddhism, as well as of his present need, the Dharmodia Sabha had appointed him as librarian and paid him a small stipend. Apart from my alms round, I did not go out very much during the first few weeks that I was alone with Tilak Dari at the Dharmodia Vihara. Neither did I get to know many people. Gayan Jyoti called occasionally, as did his manager, who saw to it that I was kept supplied with milk for my morning and afternoon tea. Hindus, sympathetic to Buddhism, came to talk to the young English monk who was staying at the Vihara, and that was about all. The first genuinely human contact I made in Kalimpong came about almost by accident. Returning from my alms round one day, I was accosted near the two silversmiths' shops by a tall, handsome Nepali, apparently a year or two older than myself, smartly dressed in immaculate Western-style clothes. Dropping to his knees directly in front of me, there in the road, he inclined his head in a deep reverence and remained in that position, with eyes closed, for several minutes. On rising to his feet, he asked me who I was and where I came from. In accordance with monastic tradition, I did not speak to anyone when I was out alms gathering, not even to the extent of returning a salutation. But so open and friendly was the young man's manner, and so alive his face with genuine interest and sympathy, that I willingly answered his questions. The result was that he subsequently came to the Dharmodiya Vihara and invited me to his house for lunch. In the course of the next few months, I was to have lunch at his house a number of times, and this way got to know him quite well. His name was Rudramani Pradhan. He came from a Hindu Newar family and was the eldest of seven brothers. His father, his two uncles, and all his younger brothers were engaged in the printing and publishing trade. He himself, much to his father's disgust, had decided to take up civil engineering. He now worked as overseer to the Kalimpong municipality. With his very beautiful wife and infant son, he lived down a narrow lane between the silversmith's shops and Nepali building, in a three-roomed bungalow so tiny as to resemble a doll's house. As I came to know later on, when I had been in Kalimpong longer and knew more people, Rudramani was well thought of by his superiors, highly popular with his contemporaries, and generally regarded as a rising young man. He had, moreover, a well-deserved reputation for integrity and public spirit. It was Rudramani's public spirit, in combination with his feeling for Buddhism, that gave me my first opportunity of carrying out Kashyapji's parting injunction and working for the good of Buddhism. A grand government-sponsored agricultural exhibition was to be held at the village of Pidong on the Bhutanese border, some 15 or 20 miles from Kalimpong. Among the organisers of the exhibition were several of his friends and colleagues, and knowing how popular he was in the locality, they appealed to Rudramani for his cooperation. His public spirit led him to respond to their appeal. His feeling for Buddhism and his friendship for me suggested to him the idea that on the opening day of the exhibition, I should give a lecture on Buddhism. To Pidong, then, I went. Besides giving my lecture, I took the opportunity of visiting the local Buddhist Gompa, a term which, in the area, indicated a temple rather than a monastery, and saw in the distance the low green hills of the Dragon Kingdom of Bhutan, of which, less than a century ago, the whole Kalimpong subdivision had formed part. At the end of my lecture, I was approached by a small, scowling man in a crumpled, ill-fitting khaki suit, with a pith helmet on his head and a Bible under his arm. So thoroughly had he been Europeanized, both within and without, that though he was very dark-skinned, it was impossible to tell whether he was an Indian or a Nepali, and whether he came from the hills or the plains. Addressing me in halting English, he asked whether I was an Englishman and whether I had been born a Christian. On my replying in the affirmative, he thumbed through his Bible, pointed an accusing finger at me, and in a voice thick with hatred, declared, "Your fate after death will be worse than that of other people. Not only have you gone astray yourself, but you are leading other people astray." In the coming months, I was to lead more and more people astray. End of chapter 1.